Hi, welcome to Things in Jars, a podcast about oddities, curiosities, and all the weird and wonderful stuff that dwells in museum stores. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Poppy, and we're both curators, here to take you behind the scenes of the museum with us as we explore cool artifacts and answer your questions about what it's really like to work in a museum.
Welcome to this week's episode of Things in Jars, and this week we are really excited to be bringing you a special episode, which is to celebrate International Ask a Curator Day, which is a celebration of all kinds of curatorial work across the whole wide world. So we thought it would be a fun thing to do to ask you to send us some questions on Instagram and Twitter about being a curator, and today we are going to answer them.
You asked, we, the curators, will answer. If you don't see your question, or if this is inspired questions you didn't even know you had, then the party's not over yet. It's continuing in full force on Twitter, and museums from all over the world are participating.
We'll be on Twitter as well all this day to answer questions, so if you have questions that you want to send directly to us on Twitter, then you can. But also, lots of other museums and curators throughout the day pose questions to the Twitter sphere for other people to jump on and answer. So it actually, what often ends up happening is really fun exchanges between museums and curators and people who are just interested in the world of curating. And the questions range from the kind of serious to the crazy.
We like the crazy. They're our favourite kinds of questions.
So it's really fun. That's why we're bringing you this episode one day early on the 16th of September, because we are celebrating Ask a Curator Day. But as usual, we will be bringing you an item spotlight this week, and Poppy has chosen something for us.
I'm going to be telling you about Athena, the owl that belonged to Florence Nightingale and can be found in the Florence Nightingale Museum.
Before we get into the rest of the episode, we'd just like to clarify that opinions expressed in this show are our own, and Things in Jars is not affiliated with the museum in which we work, although we will be referring a lot to its wonderful collection. So the first question we have was sent in by Courtney, and the question is, have you ever worked with a dangerous object, a firearm, an item with radiation, etc.?
I love this question. I saw this on Instagram and I was like, yes, this is the kind of spirit of Ask a Curator that I love so much. I would say to this one, we do have weapons in the collection. We have worked with pistols, although they're not loaded. We have guns as well, also not loaded. So I've never felt unsafe when I've been working with these items. I would say the thing I have probably felt most nervous about was when I had to pack and move three enormous scythes with like blades as long as my arm. We were doing a massive collections move project in 2019, where we had to decant the entirety of the museum, Dove Cottage, absolutely everything needed a new home. So we were up close and personal with a lot of interesting objects, and that was, those sides stay with me to this day as being a little bit worrying.
Yeah, actually, when you get to thinking about it, there are a couple of dangerous type of things, aren't there? Like when I first started thinking about this question, I was like, well, not much danger to be found in a library with manuscripts and books, but I stand corrected, and yeah, we do have a few weapons. And also, actually, not to give too much away about our upcoming episode next week, but there's a really interesting discussion in that, actually, about seemingly innocuous objects that are not as safe as they seem.
Yeah, I think as curators, we put our lives on the line absolutely every day. I mean, we're pretty hardcore. So, in short, we've not worked with firearms, but we have seen some stuff. Sometimes our job feels scary.
Yeah, I think the scythes are the ones that, yeah, they be scary. They're big.
They're very big. They poke through the bubble wrap.
Not even bubble wrap can contain them.
No, many, many travel blankets were required.
So for our next question, we have one submitted by Abby, who actually sent in a couple of questions, which we'll be getting on to answering, but we've picked this one to start with. Have you made steps to make the collections you manage more accessible to the public?
Yes, we totally have. We would not be doing our jobs if we hadn't. But Melissa's probably the best one to talk about this because it's totally your job.
Yeah, it is the absolute main focus of my role as a curator to do that. And like many museums, I would say over the last couple of years, we have really embraced the digital route. So in starting a YouTube channel, in interacting much more about the collections on social media, we have hopefully made the collections more accessible to lots of different people. We've done some live streams, we've done some Q&As online, and it's actually really good. It can be such a really, really good way of communicating with people and sharing things from the collection with people all over the world who might, for whatever reason, not be able to visit or see the things in real life. So yeah, it's a very enjoyable part of the job for me, I would say.
We are also looking at making collections more accessible just to the everyday visitor to the site. So, for example, our library is open on demand. You have to make an appointment, but we will very happily show you around the archive, behind the scenes, pick a few spotlight things to show you if that is something you're interested in. That is completely free. We also participate in Heritage Open Days every year, which is very much about a whole week of activities designed to make the behind the scenes of the museum and the collections that otherwise aren't on display a little bit more visible to audiences. And Ask a Curator is a great tool for that as well. This is really a really good time for us to hear from you as to kind of what you want to see. You send us prompts like show us your weirdest item, show us something red, and we will deliver. We will show you all of those things.
The next question we have is from Natalie, who asked, what makes a successful curator?
I would say that a successful curator needs to be a good problem solver. Sometimes you have to make things happen on a very shoestring budget. Sometimes you have to kind of improvise when you're thinking of ways to display things or ways around a particular conservation problem. So I'd say problem solving is a must. I'd also say you have to be creative because you want to engage people with your collections in ways that they haven't seen before, and it helps if you're an ideas person and you can kind of connect people to things in a way that they maybe didn't expect, or you can find ways to interest people who wouldn't otherwise be interested in what you're saying. So that's valuable. And lastly, I would say you probably need to be quite adaptable, because being a curator, it means being a lot of things and wearing a lot of hats. So you do DIY, you do visitor services, you sell tickets in the shop, you unclog toilets occasionally, and then there are all the regular parts of a curator's job on top. So sometimes when you get into work, your day doesn't pan out the way you thought it would in the morning. You kind of have grand plans to do some cataloguing and then maybe sort out some storage or whatever, but actually you end up doing a million other things instead. So you've got to be able to adapt. A lot of curators are doing many people's roles a lot of the time.
Oh yeah, definitely all of those things are, I would say, a must for curator. The only thing that I would add, or just maybe even expand upon, is your second point about being creative. I think that's so, so, so important. And you've got to have a kind of a willingness and ability to be an advocate for the collection that you work with, and you've got to want to share it with other people, and you've got to find the right way to do that. So you've got to be able to weave a story together or weave a narrative that, as Poppy said, really draws people in. If you can do that, then I think that would make you a very successful curator indeed. So another question we had from Abby was, tell us about an item with a ridiculous backstory. which is a very good question. Also, quite a challenging question, actually, because you don't want to disappoint with your answer. So it's got to be very ridiculous to make it onto Things in Jars.
Oh, man. I wish you hadn't said that. I feel like mine's going to be a disappointment. Yeah, a challenging question, because I can think of a lot of items with good backstories or kind of like amusing backstories, but ridiculous. Are any of them ridiculous? So what I've gone for, I hope, is good enough for you, Abby. I picked something that's in our collection at the moment, but it's not technically. It doesn't belong to us. It's on loan. And it's two letters written by US President Woodrow Wilson, because Woodrow Wilson's mother was from Carlisle, which is in Cumbria. And because of this, he made several trips over to the Lake District in his lifetime. During these trips, he went on little cycling tours. He came through Rydal, he came through Grasmere. He said that he was haunted by its charm. So he really enjoyed the Lake District. And while he was president, he wanted to book another trip. So the letters that we have are letters to hotels in the village of Grasmere, arranging his stay. But the reason why they're ridiculous, the first letter that we have was typewritten by Wilson to, I think, it's the hotel that is now Daffodil, and I'm sorry if I'm wrong about this. And it's basically asking to book a room for X many people on X many nights, to which I bet when they received that, they were super excited. President's coming, big news. The second letter was sent very shortly after the first, and it's Woodrow Wilson saying, oh, actually, I'm really sorry. I thought you were a different hotel. I don't want to stay there. I meant to write to this one. So he giveth and he taketh away. So I thought that was quite a ridiculous backstory. The president, firstly, writing his own letters, i.e. booking his own holiday accommodation, not going through a secretary or anything like that. And secondly, getting it wrong.
I mean, that is quite, like, you can just imagine the poor hotel person being like, oh my goodness, whoa, the president. And then being like, oh.
So, yeah, the next day, like, ah. Anyway, he wrote to one hotel, meaning to write to another.
Foolish.
What about you, though? What's your, can you top that? What's your ridiculous item?
I have found something that's really ridiculous, but it's deliberately meant to be that way, I think. So I looked out into the world. So beyond the collection that we work with, I went out into the world and found a museum in Berlin called the Museum of Unheard Things.
Ooh.
Which immediately caught my interest, because that's a great name for a museum. And it's a small museum, and it has around 80 objects in it, kind of a range of everyday to kind of more unique objects. Each object is accompanied by a label which tells the kind of the story of its meaning or its origin. But the story has actually been created by the curator that works there. So it's not technically a true story. And the idea behind this is to kind of encourage people to think again about the everyday things in the world and view the world with kind of a bigger sense of imagination. So the one that I picked was a fossilized snail shell.
Okay.
And and its label was, it's described as being an inner snail. It's also described as being an early acidic water snail, and it is between 23 and 136 million years old. So apparently teeth of dinosaurs were not that good, so dinosaurs would swallow their food without chewing. And this was okay because dinosaurs had large amounts of gastric juice, which would allow for the decomposition of the food. But with the acid also came gastroacid algae, which would form in the warm, unlit stomach areas of dinosaurs, which could stop dinosaurs feeling hungry and digesting food properly. So it could cause problems for them. So the inner snails were therefore a lifesaver, because they would live inside the dinosaurs' stomachs and eat the algae. Basically, this was just how it was. Dinosaurs and inner snails. And the label ends with, some experts believe that changes in vegetation over time led to a change in the acid balance of a dinosaur's stomach, which led to the extinction of inner snails and subsequently dinosaurs themselves.
Whoa, that is wild.
It's not true. Like, it's completely made up, but it just really made me laugh. And the way that it's written in kind of this really dry way is so convincing. And there's so many other strange things that have these crazy backstories to them. It's just such an enjoyable read. And actually, I found an English translation of the exhibition catalogue on the museum's official website. So go and have a look, because it's really funny. Yeah. But the inner snails, it just made me laugh. The thought that it was actually the demise of the inner snails that caused the demise of the dinosaurs. So there we go.
Isn't fake nature wonderful? It's totally plausible. That's a good find. I love that.
It's a ridiculous story, even if it is not true.
Yes.
So our next question that we had sent in was, how do you deal/approach objects with ethical issues behind them? For example, looted objects or cultural appropriation.
This is a really tough one for both of us, because it's a really hot topic in museums, and rightly so, but it's not something that Melissa or I have ever had experience of dealing with. It's not a concern that's at the forefront of our minds where we work, because of the nature of the collection that we work with.
For us both personally, you know, I'd like to think that we'd both approach this with great care and sensitivity and display and treat any objects with total honesty and transparency and look to acknowledge the history behind them and not kind of hide away from that.
I'm not sure if the question is kind of getting at whether we would be open to returning things to their country of origin, but I'm sure we would be if that was, I mean, that would be an organisational decision, but all you can do is be sensitive and respectful of these things and the cultures. And we're both doing a lot of reading into this because it's an area that we don't feel like we know as much. It's an area of museum practice where we both kind of feel that we haven't got as much knowledge or as much experience as we like to have. And I think in light of this summer and all the Black Lives Matter protests, a lot of museums are revising the way they think about collections and how they were acquired and what the sensitivities are, and so that's going to be a good thing for the sector, and I really hope there'll be more guidance in the sector on what museums can and should be doing.
So the next question we had is also another very topical question at the moment, and that is how to find a job, especially during the pandemic, as the cultural sector is down.
That is, again, another tough question, and one that we don't really have an amazing answer for, sadly. As you say, the sector is absolutely on its knees. Thousands and thousands of people across the country, and I'm sure across the world, are being made redundant. And these are people who, you know, super, super qualified people, people who have all the skills and experiences under their belt. It just is, sadly, what's happening now. And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that are very scared for their jobs. So unemployment, even more so than it already is going to be a huge thing for the sector in the years to come. All we can suggest is you have to keep applying. If you can afford to, if you're in a position to, if you really want it, keep applying, keep persevering. We made a episode about our tips for ensuring that your application is the best it can be going into applying for jobs. So maybe give that a listen back. They're just little things, little tips that hopefully go a long way to making sure that you are presenting yourself in a good light to prospective employers. So all you can do is make sure, you know, you're not making any careless errors, because the standard is going to be higher than ever. You really, really need to make sure you have the basics, grammar, spelling, punctuation, hitting the job spec, all of that. You need to be doing that. And just keep going. And honestly, Who knows how the sector is going to look? It might take a long time. Jobs are scarce. It's going to be really hard. I don't want to sugarcoat it, because it's tough. It's really, really tough. And a lot of us are thinking about whether we can even stay in the sector with it being how it is.
I'm afraid I am very much with you on that one, in that there's not an answer that I can give you with much confidence. I mean, yeah, if it's a question of kind of keeping an eye out for jobs when they do come up, you know, make sure that you are very active on all of the networks and places where jobs might be posted. So on social media, on websites, if there's a particular place that you're really looking to work, you know, check their website and their social media and other communications. But honestly, I think it's really important to be realistic. Things aren't like what they used to be. You know, we're being told that it's probably going to take years to come back from this, to get to any sense of kind of normality. So I would say, if you have your heart set on a job in this sector, which you probably do as you've asked this question, then maybe with yourself, kind of make a plan of how you can stay in this for the long haul. So are there any things that you can be doing to kind of keep you motivated, keep your knowledge and your skills up to date? Talking about volunteering, I was thinking about this kind of carefully, because volunteering is kind of one of those double-edged swords. A lot of museums will be really struggling right now, and there could be some great volunteering opportunities coming up where you could really have a chance to get involved in some museum work and make your mark. On the other hand, you don't want to be getting into anything where volunteering roles are kind of replacing the roles that have been lost, and, you know, you don't want to be taken advantage of or anything like that. So that's something you have to kind of think about carefully and make sure you're volunteering in a place where you are getting as much out of it as you are putting in. It could be a really opportunity, as I say, though, to make a big difference to a museum, and maybe that could open up some opportunities later down the line. Yeah, I think maybe just approach it with a sense of awareness of about how the sector is, and see what happens. I'm sorry we can't kind of give you a more encouraging answer. I think, you know, what Poppy and I say and our kind of feeling towards it probably would be echoed by a lot of other people who work in the sector right now.
It's a sad reality. Let's move on to a happier question. Hopefully one where we can inject a bit of spirit, cheer, back into proceedings.
Our next question is one that both Poppy and I have kind of been deliberating over a fair amount, because it's such a good question that we wanted again to come up with a really good answer. And this was actually submitted by my friend Bob. So thank you, Bob, for giving us this challenging question to answer. The question is, what have you got in your collection that makes you think, why did someone keep hold of this for so long, and how did it end up in your hands? So it's a great question.
It's a great question. I mean, marks to Bob for really, you know, providing us with something to think about. I have been pondering this for maybe 3 days now, and I have nothing. So, Melissa, please tell me yours and maybe I'll be inspired.
I kind of thought about this in a, you know, why did someone keep hold of this for so long? As in, like, a really kind of ordinary object that doesn't look special at all. And it's just like, why would someone keep this? So I found in our collection at Wordsworth Grasmere, we have a wooden bar with a hole through one end. So it's just a plank of wood.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really... it's literally a plank of wood. And if you looked at that, you'd be like, what? Literally, why did someone keep this for so long? And why is it in this museum? But there's actually a nice story behind this wooden bar. So if you'd looked at it closely, you would see that there was a label attached to it. Latch of original wishing gate bought at sale of Miss Quillenan. Miss Quillenan was the daughter of Edward Quillenan. She was called Jemima. And Edward married the daughter of William Wordsworth, Dora. So Edward had two daughters from his first marriage and then married Dora. So that's who she is. But the wishing gate sounds interesting, doesn't it? So the wishing gate is found just above Dove Cottage at Grasmere on a lovely little lane overlooking Grasmere Lake. And local tradition has it that if you make a wish at the farm gate, which is still there now, although it's different. It's not a wooden gate. It's not the original gate. If you make a wish here, it will be granted. And Wordsworth actually wrote a poem about the Wishing Gate called The Wishing Gate. He included at the start of the poem the following lines. So he said, "In the Vale of Grasmere, by the side of the old highway leading to Ambleside, is a gate which, time out of mind, has been called the Wishing Gate from a belief that wishes formed or indulged there have a favourable issue."
Aww.
So because Wordsworth wrote this poem about the Wishing Gate, the location of the gate became a bit of a site of worship for Wordsworth fans, so they would come to the Lake District to visit the Wishing Gate and make a wish. The original gate began to rot and it was replaced. And at this point, that was when the original wooden bar from the Wishing Gate was saved. So our records state that it was a gift of T.H. Telford before 1938, who apparently was an antique seller who lived very close to Dove Cottage. So that is how it came to the Wordsworth collection. So you have a very ordinary piece of wood that actually was part of a possibly magical gate, but also part of the story of Wordsworth's poetry. So there we go.
A magical gate. That's a great answer. I've had a flash of inspo.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I mean, I like the way you approach that. So what I would suggest for this one is, I don't know how it came into the collection, and it's maybe cheating because it's just one page out of a massive sketchbook, but one of my favourite items in the collection, just because it's so weird, is a tiny pencil sketch of a man falling over a brick wall.
Yeah.
It's in a, I think the sketchbook was by an unknown artist, and they look quite amateur. It's not like a super professional sketch or anything. And that's, I think, partly why it's funny, because the guy, the proportions aren't quite right, so it doesn't actually look like he's tripped over anything. It's just like he's falling in some bricks. But yeah, it's a wonderful piece of art, and I don't know the story behind it. I don't know who the man is or what the incident is depicting. I don't know why anyone would hold on to that for so long. Probably just because it's amusing. But shout out to that, because I'd love to know more about it. I want those answers. Will we ever get
them? Will we ever know?
Probably not. I think I'd dredge that out literally every Ask a Curator today, because it's great.
It is funny. I can see it so vividly in my mind.
Yeah.
So next up, we have a question from Amy, which is, if you could change one thing about museum culture, what would it be?
This is a really good question and a really thoughtful question. And honestly, there are a lot of things I would change about museum culture, because it's very problematic in a lot of ways, shall we say. But I think out of all of them, the thing I would change is the insecurity of the sector, because it's something that I've really struggled with, which basically just means I really, really hate how contracts are so short. So you never really know what your future's going to look like, how long you're going to be at a certain place. You're not really in a position to be able to like seriously think about setting down roots in a place, because you could be moving from anywhere, like from 3 months potentially up to 2 years is pretty much the standard length of a contract, and that's if you're lucky. There are so few permanent contracts out there because the sector has so little funding that is secure. So we tend to find ourselves having to move around a lot just to go where there are jobs. And that's tough. I mean, it's really, really tough financially to be always having to kind of start from scratch. It's tough. It is one of the things that is not really spoken about in the sector, and it's hard to live like this. It's hard emotionally not to know how long you've got in the sector and whether you're even going to be able to get a job after this contract ends. It's hard to work up to the end of a contract without really knowing if it's going anywhere, whether you should be preparing to move, whether you should be job hunting. There's a lot of, yeah, the insecurity is very, makes living quite difficult, and kind of feeling good about your future quite difficult. There's not a lot of planning that could go on. So that's what I would say. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that is a difficult thing. And I think in a similar way, jobs within museums can be so rewarding, and there's so much to love about working in a museum, but the kind of logistics of it just often, as Poppy says, is problematic. So I kind of got to thinking about how to make just the whole kind of employment in the museum world fairer. So things like salaries, things like entry routes into the sector. Just, I would love to see things just be a bit more open, a bit more fair, a bit more inclusive, diverse. And I know a lot of work is and conversation around that is going on right now, but I would just love to see more people having the opportunity to work in the museum world that doesn't involve the one traditional entry route. And then when you get to that museum job, you are paid fairly and consistently for the skills that you bring. So our final question was sent in by Annie. And that is, if you could work anywhere, where would it be?
Well, what this podcast has proven to me is that circus is truly my calling. So if ever a job came up with a circus collection, that would be my absolute dream. I knew it before, but like the circus episode that we did really did fill me with so much joy and light that I wish I could do that every day.
Actually, now that you've said that, I feel like thinking back on the episodes that we've done, and the ones that have brought me the most joy, the children's literature one really made my heart sing. Like, I just love that. It is true that this podcast has given us the opportunity to really explore the collections that we love, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been a learning experience for all of us.
So we can't finish the episode without our usual object spotlight of the week. So, what have you got for us, Poppy?
I have the pet owl of Florence Nightingale, who was called Athena, and she lives in the Florence Nightingale Museum in London. It's kind of a sad story, so grab your tissues and we'll get started. Athena the owl was discovered in Greece outside the Parthenon in 1850. She was just a teeny tiny owlet, a baby owl, and she fell from her nest, and some children found her and were tormenting her, so Florence intervened, and that was the beginning of a beautiful friendship between Florence Nightingale and Athena the owl. Athena used to sit in her little apron pocket as she did her work. Florence named her after the Greek goddess of war and wisdom, which is a good strong name. Any owl would be lucky to have it. And Florence like completely hand-reared this baby owl. So feeding her, training her. Oh yeah, she trained her to bow and curtsy. How cool is that? Yeah, so they were pretty close for a good many years. But then sadly, Florence had to go to Crimea to help with the war over there. And she left Athena in the care of some friends who had an attic, and the idea was that Athena would live in the attic and they would kind of administer to her there. While Florence was preparing to leave and Athena was in her new home, she died, sadly, because the friends turned out to be pretty bad caregivers and they just didn't check on her. It's every pet owner's nightmare, so it's very, very sad, but because Athena had never had to hunt or find food for herself, she just kind of perished, which is really, really sad. So Florence hadn't left yet, and she delayed going just so that she could get Athena taxidermied and take her with her to the Crimea. And the taxidermied bird was kept for the rest of Florence's days, and then once she died, it was given to her sister, who wrote a book about Athena the owl. It was called The Life and Death of Athena, an Owlet. Eventually, Athena was given to a care charity called Age Care, who also owned the family home of the Nightingales, and she was loaned to the Florence Nightingale Trust, and then eventually she became part of their collection. They had a fundraising bid to buy her, and that is where she can be found now.
That that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thank you so much, as always, for listening, and thank you for sending in your questions once again.
There were a few that we didn't get round to or have time for, so we're sorry that we didn't answer those. We will be participating in Ask a Curator on Twitter. Get in touch on there if you have more that you want to know about what we think about museums or about our jobs or our favourite collections. Let us know, you can get us on there. Probably also be on Instagram as well, but maybe not. It's not so much of a thing on there, but I'll make it a thing. I'll bring it to Instagram. Yeah, so thank you. Hopefully you all enjoyed that.
Next week's episode
is a cracking one. We're going to be continuing our discussion of hazardous, dangerous collections, and we're going to be doing an exploration into poisons. It's going to be really good.
We also have an exciting announcement to share with you. Poppy and I, it's probably no secret, love the spooky, the haunted. And we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could do something within the Things in Jars world to celebrate our love of all things haunted, spooky, bizarre, fantastic, and combine it with museum collections. So that's just what we've done. So something is coming to our social media channels.
Something wicked
is coming to our social media channels this Friday. Be sure to follow our Instagram, follow us on Twitter, and you will be the first to see what we have planned for the month of October and Halloween. If you like what we're doing and you want to support the podcast, you can head over to our Patreon, where you will find extra item spotlights, bonus content, and much more exciting stuff. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Poppy.
Thank you very much for listening.
And we'll see you next week.